Silence over eyes. Please be seated.
Yes, Ms. Hedge.
Thank you, Commissioner. I call Alan Russell McNevin, who's present in the witness box.
Yes, Mr. McNevin, will you take an oath or make an affirmation?
Affirmation.
Yes. Do you affirm that you will tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do.
Thank you. Ms. Hedge?
Thank you. You are Alan McNevin?
Yes.
You're currently a reporting scientist at the Queensland Forensic and Scientific Services DNA Laboratory?
Yes.
You provided three statements to the Commission, is that right?
Yes.
All right. The first of those is WIT. Sorry, just one moment. My apologies. The first of those is WIT.0040.0001.0001, dated 21st of September 2022. And it primarily deals with your work history, the options paper, and the update paper. You remember that statement?
Yes.
All right, thank you. The second is WIT.0040.0018.0001. Have that up. It was sworn 10th of October 2022 and deals with OQIs and two particular OQIs from 2012.
Yes.
All right. And the third statement is WIT.0040.0077.0001. And it was signed last Thursday, 13th of October, and deals with phones, validation, sperm microscopy, and DNA IQ extraction.
Yes.
Is that right? All right.
Yes.
And those are all the statements you've provided to the Commission so far?
Yes.
Thank you. In that third statement, there are a number of exhibits, and exhibit 99 and 100. Which appear on page 62 of that third statement, are two reports prepared by a company called Livingstone's, which were provided to you in a redacted form.
Yes.
All right. I understand you're content to remove those exhibits or withdraw them from your statement so they don't form part of your statement before the Commission. Is that correct?
I'm okay with that, yes.
All right. So in exhibit 90, Commissioner, these three statements of Mr. McNevin have been tendered. So could it be identified that for item number three on exhibit 90, that the exhibits ARM 99 and ARM 100 are withdrawn from that statement?
I'm sorry, could you tell me what you mean by that? Exhibits 1, 2, and 3 are Mr. McNevin's statements.
That's right.
Or items 1, 2, and 3 are Mr. McNevin's statements, yes.
And in the third of those,
yes,
the within that statement,
yes,
exhibits ARM 99 and ARM 100,
yes,
will be withdrawn or removed from that document, so that what's tendered before the Commission is the statement and all of the other exhibits, not including those two.
All right. That's fine. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, can we start with sperm microscopy? And, well, perhaps I should say generally, your statement, your third statement is the one that I will ask you some questions about. And it is a very comprehensive statement of your involvement in those topics I mentioned.
Yep.
All right, so you understand I won't take you through every part of it, but just some specific parts of it.
Yes.
All right. Can we start with very brief timeline of your involvement in the sperm microscopy issue? Were you aware that the issue was raised in late 2015 and early 2016 by some reporting scientists?
To be honest, I'm not sure when I was first made aware.
Okay. And at that time, you were the senior scientist in charge of the evidence recovery?
Yes, I was. Yes.
All right. So you weren't in the same team with those people who raised it, Ms. Wilson, Mr. Pathia, Ms. Reeves,
that's correct, yes.
Ms. Rika, they're all in different teams.
They were, yes.
All right. And you took some leave, is that right, between about March and May 2016?
Yes, I can't really remember. But...
Okay. So do you remember what occurred from when the matter was allocated to you by Mr. House? The investigation of the matter?
I actually can't quite remember how it all started, to be honest. And so my best recollections are from what I could find from email records and meeting minutes and that sort of thing.
All right. When it was allocated to you, do you remember whether Mr. Howes indicated what level of urgency he thought it needed to be dealt with?
From my memory, I don't remember Justin being the one discussing it with me first, that I had some sort of conversations with either Paula, who was my line manager, or I think around that time Paula was also had been on maternity leave or was just coming back from maternity leave. So I may have had conversations with whoever was acting in Paula's role beforehand.
All right.
I don't actually really remember exactly how it was actually raised to me initially, the initial part of it.
All right.
Yeah.
Do you remember whoever raised it with you, what level of urgency that person suggested it needed to be dealt with?
I don't remember it being raised as a particularly urgent issue. At the time.
And what about when you had spent a little time getting acquainted with what the issue was? Did you then think it was an urgent issue?
Well, we'd been using the same process for quite a number of years, so it didn't seem like this was something like where we'd just implemented a change and then that change was going, you know, bad. It was something that had been in place for quite a long time and the issue was only just being raised. So I thought it was important to... just deal with it in a, you know, a structured, orderly manner.
So do I take it from that you didn't see the need to make any urgent changes?
It didn't seem to be, no.
Now, can I take you to page 240, paragraph 243 of your third statement, which is page 42 of your brochure?
101?
Paragraph 243, page 42. You were asked in the question which precedes this paragraph about whether there was any workplace culture or environment issues that impeded the efficient resolution of the issue, and you identified in the following paragraphs that there was some aspects of the culture within the laboratory had contributed to the delay in dealing with Project 181 and the sperm microscopy issue.
Yes.
All right. And in particular, in paragraph 243, you mention a management meeting in June of 2016 where you let your emotions get the better of you and raise your voice towards Mrs. Reeves.
Yes.
All right. And you've heard some evidence about that at this commission so far, about that event?
Yes.
All right. Is it the case that you apologised to Ms. Reeves by email on that day?
Yes.
Could I just have that on the screen? FSS.0084.0081. And is this a copy of that email that you sent on the same morning as the meeting?
Yes.
All right. Thank you. That was item number 28 in the index that's already been tendered. Thank you. Now, could I go back to your third statement and to page 32, paragraph 186? And can we go back to this question of urgency of response? You see that you said there that Ms. Reeves and Ms. Rika were advocating for a halting of all examinations for spermatozoa until the problem was resolved?
Yeah, that's kind of the way I remember the conversation.
Yes.
Just my best memory of something that happened a while ago.
Of course.
Yeah.
And was this, did this occur at the very early part of the of Project 181, that is in May and June of 2016, or is this conversation of a later time?
No, I think that's more pretty early in the piece.
Okay.
If I remember correctly.
So early on, could I just ask you to speak a little louder for me?
Yeah,
I'm just having trouble hearing
you. If I recall correctly, it was early in the piece, yeah.
Thank you. So from early on when you were dealing with it, Ms. Rika and Ms. Reeves considered some urgent action should be taken, and the majority of the management team seemed satisfied with gathering data before taking any action.
That's my memory, yes.
All right. And then in August of 2016, you implemented what I might describe as the workaround of, for every case, looking at the diff-lysis slide?
Yes.
All right. Are you content with that phraseology, the workaround, or would you prefer to call it something else?
That's fine, yes. I think we referred to it as a workaround in the lab. So.
Okay, good. So now thinking back, is there any reason why you didn't implement that workaround earlier?
From what I remember, I wanted to get some information to determine if there was a problem before we actually did anything. You know, if someone raises an issue, the first thing you need to do is determine if there is an issue before you then proceed with doing anything in response to that. Now, sometimes that's immediately obvious. Sometimes it's less obvious.
And is that workaround the obvious workaround to put in place to deal with the issue, or is it just one of a number of potential workarounds that you could have implemented?
I think that was probably the most obvious one, I guess.
Yes.
It was a few years ago now, so.
All right.
Yeah.
And, I suppose if the problem is a discrepancy between two slides, looking at both of them does seem to a non-scientist the most obvious way of resolving
it. But we didn't look at all of both sets. We just looked at those ones where there was nothing seen on the first slide. So let's look at the second slide.
Do you mean after the workaround?
Yes. All right. Sorry, that's what I thought we were talking about.
Yes, no, we are. So I was just checking you weren't talking about that data analysis.
No.
So after the workaround, if there was no sperm on the ER slide, you would look at a diff-lysis slide?
From what I remember, yes.
All right. So what would have been the negative, if anything, of implementing that workaround in May or June 2016 when you first were allocated to the project?
It was a bit more work for my team. It wasn't a huge impost, but it was still, you know, a double handling of exhibits that took extra time and resources. So as a manager, you have to weigh those things up. But I kind of don't really remember having a conversation about the workaround at any point. So I don't really remember at what point it was proposed and at what point we decided to implement and who actually suggested it. I'm sorry, I can't actually recall how that came about.
Okay. Exactly. I was going to ask who would be the person to determine, would it be yourself or your line manager or their line manager who would have determined that workaround?
It could have just been a conversation in the management team. Just had in a meeting or something. I can't exactly recall.
Okay.
But it didn't necessarily fall upon just me as the manager of the evidence recovery team. Any manager or even any sort of staff member had a good idea, could have raised it, and then that could have been considered and implemented. So I couldn't tell you whose initial idea it was to let's just do things this way. It could have been my idea too. I really don't remember exactly how that came about.
All right. Just going back to something that you said a few minutes ago, you said it's important to gather data to identify whether something is a problem.
Yes.
So did you go about gathering data of discrepancies between the ER slide and the diff-lysis slide in the preceding, say, 6 months or 12 months or some other time period?
Yes, I think that was the initial part of the investigation was we did a sort of a review of a whole group of samples. I can't remember the exact methodology, but I believe that we went and looked at examples of where there had already been the two reads, the read of the evidence recovery slide and the differential lysis slide. And then I think we may have gone back to samples that I think the idea was we would look for ones that hadn't actually been through the full reporting process and found them and then went and read the differential lysis slide for those as well. So we had a broader number to compare.
You remember just approximately how many cases or samples fell into that category that you've described?
No, did I put something in my statement? Well, I can't remember.
I'm not sure that I can answer that either. But let me ask you this. After you reviewed those, were you content that there was a real problem with the preparation of the evidence recovery slides?
Well, again, in the way that you phrase it, that there was a problem with the preparation of the evidence recovery slides, I didn't know exactly, but there was some examples where there were some different results for sure.
Yes.
But they didn't necessarily make up a large number of most results were as kind of expected.
All right.
So it was a bit hard to really kind of say, aha, that's the problem, we'll work on that.
Let's just take one step back. Were you satisfied there was a problem that needed something to be done about it?
It wasn't obvious that it was a big problem or even a bit of a problem, because you do expect some sort of natural variation when you do laboratory processes. So, you know, the fact that there's some aberrant results wasn't super... It wasn't, for me anyway, looking at a larger number, it wasn't something that I went, oh, yes, there's clearly a problem. But at the same time, it didn't look like there was nothing to see either. Mm-hmm. That there was something that was worth investigating a little bit further.
Okay. All right. Can I move on to something else? Just one moment. Do you remember whether the data analysis that we just spoke of, looking at samples, was done before the workaround was introduced?
Oh, I'm not sure of that timeline, sorry.
All right. Well, do you remember whether the workaround was a response to the data?
I don't remember the timeline, so I can't say either way.
All right. Well, do you remember what the workaround was in response to?
No, like I said, I can't actually remember how we... at what point we decided to that there should be a workaround and how we came up with that decision. I can't remember whether it was a conversation between me and my manager or whether it was part of the management team or whether someone else from the management team proposed it. I don't remember finding any email records or anything or meeting minutes that were that prescriptive as to what was exactly discussed word for word. So I'm sorry, it was... A lot of things happen in our laboratory, so I don't always remember every little detail like that.
Right. Can I move on to a different topic, and that is the sampling and analysis of bone samples in the laboratory?
Mm-hmm.
And that's the first of the topics dealt with in your third statement. Could we turn to page one of that statement, please, operator, and paragraphs 2 and 3. You were the manager of the analytical team from 2006 to 2014 and then the evidence recovery team 2014 to 2021.
Yes.
All right. And you heard Ms. Keller give evidence, Ms. Angelina Keller, I should say, give evidence last week that at the time you took over the role of senior scientist in the evidence recovery team, as far as she knew, you didn't have any experience with bone sampling or
Correct.
Bone reporting.
Correct.
All right. And you accept that that is accurate?
When I took over the team, yes.
And in paragraph 3, you set out what you did to increase your skills and become knowledgeable in the areas of evidence recovery that you hadn't been knowledgeable in before you became that manager.
So not just bone sampling, but all areas of the evidence recovery task.
Yes. And so did that include bones? Well, in fact, yes. You say that there, that it included the collection, testing and analysis of bone samples.
Mm.
You gained some hands-on experience, learnt from your team members and read associated textbooks, journal articles and so on.
Yes.
All right. And from that, you developed a sufficient knowledge base to then make some decisions about bone sampling. Is that correct?
Yeah.
All right. And Ms. Keller also gave some evidence about the use of Turgazyme in the laboratory.
Mm-hmm.
And can I take you to page 11 of your statement paragraph 59. So this was a change in the bone cleaning protocol, and that was a matter that was raised with you by Mr. Goodrich. Who's that?
So Michael is the senior laboratory assistant in the laboratory.
All right. And so he's a trained scientist?
No, Michael's not a scientist. He's a laboratory assistant.
All right. Are there qualifications that are required for that is what I...
Oh, sorry. No. It's it doesn't require a special qualification now, but...
I see. And did you say he's the senior laboratory assistant?
So yes. I'm actually not really sure exactly what his role description is, but right. There's a group of laboratory assistants and he's the senior one of that.
All right. And are the laboratory assistants, Mr. Goodrich and others, in charge of things like cleaning equipment?
Yeah, so they do some of the cleaning of the laboratory equipment and consumables and that sort of thing, and they stock cupboards and those sorts of things. Help the scientists.
Yes.
Basically.
So he would have been using the turpentine, the detergent.
Don't think it was. I think he may have been just looking at our chemicals that we have and how we store them. He may have even been doing some sort of health and safety audit. I'm not really sure exactly why it came to his attention, but it did, obviously.
Yes. Right. Can we go to that email that you attached there? It's wit.0040.0077.0257. Is it? So if you go to the fourth of those pages, to wit.0040.0077.0001. I see. Sorry, it's page 259. My apologies, I wrote it. Thank you. And then just the page immediately above that. Email at the bottom of the page there. That's you asking, following up, Mr. Goodrich, about the Turgazine question. Is that right?
Yeah. So I seem to remember maybe Michael come and spoke to me, and I thought it might be easier if he just put all his information in an email so then I could follow up on it rather than just relying on my memory. Looks like it was Friday afternoon. I thought it was easier, something I could then deal with on the Monday or something.
And he responded and told you his concerns?
Yeah.
Next email?
And I can see there he's reviewing the specifications and technical info pages on the supplier website. So for whatever reason, he must have been looking at that information and that's what brought it to his attention.
All right.
I would imagine.
Now, if we scroll up one more page again, you then forwarded the email to Ms. Brasotto, who was your line manager.
Yes, she was my line manager at the time.
Dr. Scott, who was the quality senior scientist.
Yes, and just to put that in context, Kirsten would also be Michael's boss.
I see.
Yes.
And Sharon Byrne, can you explain her role?
Yeah, so Sharon was the workplace health and safety representative for the laboratory at the time.
All right. And looking at that, your email, you say, given some issues with using or disposing of Turgazine, should we implement the alternative protocol using the dishwasher as outlined in proposal 148?
Yes.
All right. And I assume you've seen proposal 148. Was that done while you were the senior scientist?
Yeah, I think it was finished when I was taking over the role of evidence recovery, but it might have started prior to my role.
I see. You were aware of the
I was aware of it, yes.
And you were aware that it related only to the bone crushing mill?
Yes.
Part? It wasn't all bone equipment, it was just that one...
I think because there was a little bit of time between that project finished and when that email was sent, I think I'd actually asked one of my staff members to go back and have a bit of a read and let me know what was in it.
All right.
I probably didn't remember exactly.
And the minor change that was implemented after that, going back to your statement, I'll just take you back there first. Do you see, so your statement, page 11, please, paragraph 61. You say, consulted with the management team and implemented a change. And do you remember that that change was to have the particular part of the bone equipment that Project 148 had related to dealt with how Project 148 suggested?
Yes.
And all other bone equipment to be dealt with the ethanol and 70% trigene, is that right? I'm sorry, I've drove that the wrong way around.
No, that's
trigene,
okay.
And 70% ethanol.
Yes, I believe from the top of my head, trigene is used in potentially a 5% volume per volume solution. But
all right.
I'm not sure exactly what how trigene, whether it gets diluted or not.
Yes, that's all right.
But the ethanol, 70%, yes. Trigene was the product, yes.
It was bleached trigene and 70%
ethanol. Yeah, and or, yes, so you wouldn't use all three.
Yes.
You would use different combination depending on what you're cleaning.
All right, yes. That's my fault for not saying it specifically enough. Bleach slash trigene and then 70% ethanol.
Yes.
Right? All right. Now, that was implemented at that time for all other pieces of bone equipment, chisels and other things, saws and so on.
Yes, and it's my understanding that that was the process we were already using to clean the general laboratory environment as well in that area.
Yes. And was there a specific validation done for bone equipment for that process, to your knowledge?
No.
And do you think such a specific validation was necessary?
Well, given the sort of widespread use of those cleaning protocols for everything else in the laboratory, it didn't seem particularly unusual that whilst that bone sampling equipment is different equipment to what might be used in other processes, it's still just equipment that needs cleaning.
All right. Now, Ms. Keller also gave evidence that you and Mr. Howes had the view that soft tissue samples should be processed when possible before any bone samples from a DVI type incident?
Yes.
All right, and why do you hold that view?
So soft tissue samples are able to be processed in our standard laboratory process. So they can just slot into the regular extraction, quantification, et cetera, processes that we have in our laboratory. So they don't require a specific sampling technique. Everything requires its own specific sampling technique, but not a bone sampling is a rather labor-intensive sampling technique, whereas it's a much simpler technique to sample some soft tissue, and then that can just slot into a regular DNA extraction batch that has lots and lots of other samples on it, so it doesn't require a specialized DNA extraction batch. So we can get a rapid turnaround of that result by just slotting it into the normal routine processes. And that doesn't mean that it's not an either or. You can't just do tissue or just do bone. You could just quickly do the tissue, and if it works, great, get a result, don't need to do the bone. If it doesn't work, we can go back and do the bone. So you don't necessarily have to look at it as an either or, more as a thinking about it in a broader context of how you fit samples into the routine flow of a laboratory.
All right. Now, you also heard Ms. Keller give evidence about a number of mixed profiles that she's seen for bones in the last perhaps 18 months or so.
Yes, I heard that evidence.
All right. And you say in your statement you weren't aware of that prior to hearing her evidence?
No.
All right.
I was completely oblivious.
Oblivious, did you say?
Yeah, I hadn't been. Sorry. I should have worked
out. I just didn't quite hear you.
Yes, she hadn't. No one had actually discussed with me that there was an issue with mixtures in bone samples of late.
All right. And you finished being the senior scientist in the evidence recovery section in November 2021, is that right?
Yeah, I think I started as a reporter in November 2021, early in the month, maybe even the start of the month.
And are you competent in the scientific use of that word to report on bones?
No, I haven't received the specific. So it's not really reporting on bones as such as the type of calculations that you do when you're using bones for identification purposes, so that
okay.
the parentage testing and that sort of thing.
I see.
I haven't.
So do you report on bones?
No.
All right.
Yeah.
And so you haven't personally come across.
No, sorry, because yes, so I wouldn't have come across any samples, any profiles from bones, so I wouldn't be aware that there's a problem if no one had actually said to me there's a problem.
All right. And you say in your statement that you can't form a concluded view about whether there is a problem with mixed profiles unless you went and looked at all of those profiles yourself, determined what sort of mixtures there were and so on.
Yes, just like I said before with the sperm microscopy, you need to look at the data to see what the problems are. So without seeing all the information, I can't draw any conclusions or statements.
All right. Assuming they are mixed profiles that show clear multiple profiles, would you consider that a problem for the analysis of bones?
Look, as a general rule, yes, but I would need to know what the issues are around it, you know, what sort of bones they were, how the sampling was done, what was all the nature of it. Is it the mixture arising from the bone itself, or is it arising from some other process? There's just too many variables to just make a general sort of sweeping statement about that.
All right. Can I deal with a final topic, which is not covered in your statement? That is about, as a reporting scientist, the information that you receive from the police about a sample and the context of the case surrounding that sample. Is it your view that receiving some further information about samples or cases would assist you to report on those samples? And if so, what sort of information do you think would assist?
Yeah, so I think it comes down to the samples you've received and the size of the case. But at times it might be useful to know whether, for example, in a sexual assault case, whether you're looking for semen or not. And certainly that's from my experience as the evidence recovery senior scientist. That was a question we may have when we received samples for testing. But, you know, just some additional information that is very sort of minimal, but it might just provide a little bit of context. Are we looking for multiple people involved in one side or other of the incident? I don't think it's really necessary to get the ins and outs of the case. You know, we don't need to know the story, just some basic information to help us decide what level of testing we need to do.
And what about from your experience in the analytical and evidence recovery teams? Do you think there's extra information that could help those teams process samples more effectively?
So from the analytical side, no, because the analytical team is about doing the mechanics of the DNA profiling. So once the sample hits the analytical team, all the way through to when the DNA profile is done, that information, those decisions should be made beforehand or can be made afterwards, but in that middle part, I don't think it really has an impact. From managing the evidence recovery team, yeah, there were times where we put samples on hold to seek more information from Queensland Police. So, you know, if we received an example that was a sample taken from some underpants and they haven't ticked that semen testing was required, did they just forget to tick semen not required, or was it a case where semen is not an issue because it's an allegation of touch. And if there'd just been some very basic information in the case page where you could just quickly check that the allegation was of touch rather than of contact with semen, then I wouldn't have had to bother someone with that question. So, there were times when a little bit of extra information would go a long way. Same if you are looking for semen, are you looking for multiple individuals or one individual? Would be a little bit useful. If you're sampling a very large item and there's multiple areas that are positive for semen, are we looking for, is there the potential that, you know, that semen has come from multiple sources, or has it just come from one? So, yeah, that sort of information would be useful. Like I said, we don't need the big story around the case. We just need enough information to enable us to do our job.
All right. And have you had the opportunity to raise that concern about, or that suggestion, perhaps is a better way of putting it, your suggestion to have more information?
Yeah, it's something
with anyone within the laboratory. Before.
Yeah. And when I say the information required to do our job, I shouldn't say that we can't do our job, because we have those communication channels with QPS. It's more a little bit more efficient if we don't have to go through the process of question and answer.
Yes.
At different times, you know, it's been a subject that I've raised before.
Okay. Who have you raised it?
I know I've spoken to my line manager before. I might have even brought it up in general discussions in the management team. I remember discussing what sort of options there may be when we're in development of the forensic register, what sort of pages or something we could sort of create that might be of use. I don't think it was it's not a very straightforward thing because it requires something at the QPS end, someone to enter data at that end or something. And I don't think it was a very easy thing to answer.
All right. And the forensic register was implemented about 2017, is that right?
Middle of 2017, I remember, yes.
All right. So this is a long-term suggestion of yours. It's not something that has come to you since you've been a reporter.
Oh, no.
You've had that view for at least 5 years.
Yeah, it's something that, yeah. Yes.
All right.
Yes.
And it's been talked about in the management team.
It's not something that we, bring up every week, but
yes,
it is. I don't believe it's a new thing that I talked about. No.
All right. And over your time in the laboratory, have you seen any change to that? And since 2017, any increase in information you're providing?
Oh, I don't think things have changed from what we see is available in the forensic register. I think we get the same information from when it was implemented, if I can recall correctly.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Mr. McNevin. Those are my questions.
Mr. Hunter.
Mr. McNevin, recall a few moments ago being asked about the decision to use a mixture of bleach, Turgazyme and 70% ethanol to clean the bone sampling equipment.
Well, not a mixture of those chemicals, but those different chemicals were discussed, yes.
Using those three chemicals to clean the bone sampling equipment?
Yes. Well, we discussed that we had been using Turgazyme, mm-hmm. and we moved to using bleach and ethanol or Trigene and ethanol.
I'm sorry, I inadvertently wrote down the wrong chemical starting with T. It's Trigene, sorry. Is that
Trigene.
Right? Gene with an E. So you're being asked by Ms. Hedge about the decision to use bleach, Trigene and ethanol to clean the bone sampling equipment.
Bleach or Trigene and ethanol.
Cool. Okay. Yes.
So you use the cleaning agent, mm-hmm. either bleach or Trigene, and then you follow that by wiping away the cleaning agent with the 70% ethanol.
Now, you were asked about that and you said that you understood that bone sampling equipment was different. Correct?
Well, it's not the same equipment that you use for other things. There's certain things like chisels and whatnot that are only used for bone sampling that you have no call to use those for other evidence recovery processes. But if they were useful in another evidence recovery process, you would use them. They don't have to be just for bone.
Given that they're different, though, why would you use necessarily the same cleaning process for them as for other items?
Well, they're only different in that you require a different tool. They're not different as in we have forceps and scissors and other cutters and things that we use throughout the laboratory. So you could, you don't need a unique cleaning protocol for every single individual different tool you have. You can use the same cleaning protocol for lots of different things.
It's important, though, that whatever you do clean them with doesn't cause them to pit or to rust.
Yeah, and that's why you would use Trigene on certain surfaces because it doesn't have the same corrosive activity as bleach.
Do you say that that there have not been problems with pitting and or rusting of the bone sampling equipment?
Well, in my time as the evidence recovery supervisor, no one had raised it to me, no.
No one has ever said to you that the method of cleaning being used was causing the equipment to either pit or rust.
Correct. So I implemented that cleaning regime, as we've discussed via those emails, and no one has come back to me to say, Alan, that wasn't the best process. Maybe we should be doing something different. There's a problem with it. I've not had that conversation with anyone.
Okay. Can I take you back, please, to August of 2017?
Sure.
In particular, this is in a period of time that's in the lead up to the adoption of what I'll call the DIFP workflow.
Okay.
You yes. understand what I'm talking
yes,
about
yes,
there?
Yes.
Can we have, please, Mr. Woolridge, WIT 0040 0002 0001 on the screen, please. These are the minutes, or these are, sorry, I should say the agenda of a meeting that's says that you were present. You see that?
Yes.
And can you go down the page to the bottom where you see for item 4.2, sub-team updates?
Yep.
Now, at this stage in 2017, which team were you working in?
I would have been looking after the evidence recovery team at that time.
All right. So you see there PMB, I assume that's Paul.
Yes.
Ms. Brizzotto.
Yes.
Staffing levels significantly reduced due to long-term leave. Resourcing to this team is being looked into.
Mm-hmm.
So you well understood at that point there were staffing issues with the evidence recovery team?
I actually don't really remember what that relates to, but I must have had some staff going off with some long-term leave and I must have requested to get more staff. I can only assume.
And can I ask you about the process of microconcentration?
Sure.
I think we understand that the normal elution process is highly automated.
Yes.
And is the quant process also automated?
Yes.
What about the microconcentration process? Does that involve manual intervention?
Yeah, it's a tube-by-tube process.
So it slows the procedure down significantly?
Slows what procedure?
Well, the process of testing.
Oh, it's a more labour-intensive test. I mean, it has an impact. Depending on how many you're doing and how often you have to do them, that might have more of an impact. But it's not a procedure done by the evidence recovery team.
It's not, all right.
It's done by the
analytical team, all right. Are there issues with staff suffering repetitive strain injuries and that sort of thing from doing microconcentration, to your knowledge?
Well, yeah, so when I managed the analytical team and I had staff that were performing microconcentration using the microcon filters, we didn't do a large batches of them, so I never had issues. But I've heard secondhand that maybe if you're doing a lot of them, you're increasing the amount of pipetting. Pipetting is where you're drawing liquid up and down, and it has a very, you know,
you're repetitive, pushing up and down.
Yeah, so it's a repetitive process that might, I would imagine, right. If not, you know, you could manage, I guess, staff rotation and stuff like that to try and manage that.
Now, can I ask you about Project 184?
You can ask me about Project 184.
Well, you know what I'm talking about.
Yes.
184. There were a number of stages to that project, were there not? There was the development of a project plan.
That's the usual thing when we do projects. Yes.
Well, do you recall seeing the project plan for Project 184?
Yes.
Could we see?
Well, I don't sort of recall. I know that I've looked back through the records and seen that I did. But sure.
Well, let's have a look, please, at FSS.0001.0001.0862. See the front page of that document?
Yes.
Do you recognise that?
I can see it's a project plan. I mean, yes, I...
Well, you see it's a project plan for Project 184?
Yeah, and as a member of the management team, I'm assuming I read it, and I probably even had to complete a risk assessment at the bottom, second page.
I'm going to come to that risk assessment in a moment. but can we start with what we see at the bottom paragraph that's currently visible, where it talks about extract with low quantification values were recommended to be concentrated. Templates of lower than 0.132 nanograms were found to exhibit marked stochastic effects after amplification.
Yes.
How does 0.0132 nanograms convert to micrograms, nanograms per microliter in terms of the standard elution value? Yeah.
The 0.132 nanograms relates to the fact that we use in the PowerPlex 21 amplification kit, you have to put 15 microliters of sample into that reaction.
Right.
Okay. So regardless of whatever concentration your sample is, 15 microliters needs to go in. Mm-hmm. So if you only have 5 microliters of sample, you need to add 5 microliters of sample plus 10 microliters of diluent, etc. So 15.132 divided by 15 gives you your 0.0088 nanograms per microliter. So 0.08 nanograms per microliter times 15 microliters equals 0.132 nanograms.
So you understood that to mean that when samples were processed and samples that had less than 0.0088 nanograms per microliter of DNA without being microconcentrated,
just straight up
exhibited marked stochastic effects, correct?
Well, you could still have that concentration after microconcentration, right? That's just the concept. So samples where the total DNA template input into your amplification reaction were less than 132 nanograms, we would see marked stochastic effects.
Okay, thank you. And can we go, please, to page, the bottom of page 2, the expected outcome. Do you see that there on the page? It's expected that mm-hmm. the data will match the anecdotal information from case managers, which has been gathered from years of experience.
Yeah, so generally speaking, if people are thinking that they see, you know, more or less of something or whatever, you would expect that if you go and look at a broader data set, you would probably see something similar to what people are reporting anecdotally, but no, it doesn't necessarily follow. That's why you need to go and look at the broader data set.
Because it's not a very scientific way to approach it, is it, to simply posit the expected outcome of the project in that way? That is what you expect. This is what you expect the data to show.
Well, it's a project proposal, right? So you have to have an...
My question to you is whether it's a scientific... It's consistent with a scientific approach to identify at the outset what you expect the outcome to be.
Well, we don't run a pure research facility. So we don't just do testing on things where we've got no idea what the answer's going to be. We would only do testing on where we have some sort of expected outcome in order for the management team to effectively determine whether that project should go ahead or not.
But surely you'd accept this proposition that suggests from the outset a bias in the approach, that is, that you expect the outcome to be a particular one, that is, that the data will accord with the anecdotal information you've received.
No, because if the data had actually shown us something different, we would have done something different.
Okay. Well, we'll come to what the data showed in a minute. Can we scroll down then to the risk assessment, which is on page 3? Thank you. So you were in charge of the evidence recovery team at that stage?
Yes.
And did you contribute to this risk assessment?
I would say I wrote that, yes. Right.
That's your cipher on the right-hand side with the date underneath it?
Yes, that's my initials and the date, yes.
Well, what sort of risks were you considering?
So it was really my role in the evidence recovery team to look at whether this process would impact upon the evidence recovery team. And as we've discussed, there really wouldn't be any impacts on the evidence recovery team as such.
Well, what do you mean by impacting on the team? You mean the people who actually physically worked in the...
Well our evidence recovery processes, our evidence recovery tasks, the people themselves, that all of those things, anything that might have an impact upon the evidence recovery team.
Well, I mean, as the name implies, the task of the evidence recovery team was the recovery of evidence, correct?
It's a catch-all term to refer to basically sampling.
Yeah. Yes.
And sampling the exhibits.
The idea being, though, that you're attempting to recover evidence in criminal cases that were being investigated by the QPS.
By that rationale, every team's an evidence recovery team.
Well, no. Wasn't your job to ensure that as far as possible or as far as practical, available evidence was identified so that it could be analysed by other scientists?
Our role was to do the sampling. That's what the evidence recovery team was.
But you're sampling so as to recover evidence, aren't you?
So as to potentially find any DNA that's present on the exhibit.
Yeah, yes. Which would be then evidence.
Well, yes, but that's no different to, as a reporting scientist, trying to interpret a DNA profile as the process of evidence recovery.
Reporting, it's not even going to get to a reporting scientist if you don't recover it, though, is it?
Well, in the same way that police need to send us the exhibits.
See, what I'm wondering, though, is whether you considered the broader risks of...
Is the answer yes, that if you don't recover the DNA, then it won't even get to the reporters?
I guess so, yes. I mean...
Thank you.
Yes, if you don't sample it correctly.
Did you consider the wider risks of what was being proposed?
Not really, because my main focus was, as the manager of the evidence recovery team, was to, are there risks in this project proceeding? And it's really about the project proceeding. Proceeding to the evidence, is there any risk to the evidence recovery team?
Well, did you not consider that there might be risks to the recovery of evidence?
I identified there that there may be some risks associated to samples.
But they're offset by process efficiency so that the results should be more timely. Yeah?
Yeah, I think that's fairly critical that we get results out in a more timely manner.
And so it doesn't matter if you miss some evidence?
No, it's not what I'm saying at all.
Well, that's the inevitable consequence of what was being proposed, isn't it?
It's just the broader practicalities of working in a scenario where we can't, it's not practical to sample everything at a crime scene. It's not practical to do everything to the nth degree.
Wait a minute.
So it's just in that broader...
You're not being asked about the crime scene.
Sorry, yeah, sorry. My apologies. I'm just thinking, in the broader sort of context that it seems...
What's the context?
The broader context of a... laboratory trying to carry out its functions.
Yes.
That it's my understanding at my very junior level of management that you just don't have the resources to do everything and spend, all the time in the world on everything.
Asked to do it. It doesn't assist me in working out what's happening here.
Okay.
If you speak in terms of doing everything in the world as though that's an impossibility, what you're being asked about is whether the lab is doing what it ought to be doing. Now, if you concentrate upon the task in front of you in the lab and the questions being asked, it'll assist me in understanding your position.
So my position at that time was, as the evidence recovery senior scientist, does this project impact upon the sampling of exhibits? And no.
Well, how can that be right when what you're being asked to approve is an experiment that might lead to samples not being tested that might yield results? Why is there no impact upon the evidence recovery team?
Because
its work would be impeded because it wouldn't be doing the work on some samples that might yield DNA for analysis.
Because all the sampling is done prior to DNA quantification. So the task that evidence recovery team would be carrying out would be exactly the same, regardless of whether there's a DNA insufficient process or not.
Don't you put samples into the genetic analyzer? Is that part of...
Not the evidence
recovery. I'm sorry, you're talking about the evidence recovery team.
Yes, I am.
Go on. Yes, Mr. Hunter. Mr. McNevin is distinguishing between his role in recovering the evidence and sending it to recovering the evidence, which is then taken by others for quantitation and a submission to the genetic analyzer, and if it's determined that some samples with a quant below a particular figure are not to be progressed beyond quantitation, that involves steps beyond the role of the evidence recovery team.
I understand that.
Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Nonetheless, you were in favour, weren't you, of some sort of triaging process coming into play to reduce the number of samples that were subject to Microcon, weren't you?
I was more just thinking on a broader context of us doing the best work we can on the sort of samples that give us the most amount of information.
I'll ask you the question again. You were in favour, weren't you, of adopting an approach that resulted in fewer samples being subject to microconcentration?
Well, I suppose ultimately that was the process in question, but it wasn't specifically about Microcon. Wasn't specifically about reducing the number of samples that go to Microcon. It was just about whether we could be a more efficient laboratory.
And one way you saw it of being more efficient was by not testing low quant samples.
I don't believe it was just about not testing them straight up. It was about, not testing them straight up, but having the ability, therefore, them to be tested at a later date if they were seen before.
But that's what happened, isn't it? That they simply would not get tested if they were quantitated in that DFP range.
Unless we were asked to do further testing by Queensland Police.
Okay. Now, can we go, please, to an email that you sent, and perhaps before we go to it, do you recall that there was a project paper prepared by Mr. Howes and circulated for
initial
feedback?
Sort of report as part of this project, yes.
And you provided feedback to him on more than one occasion?
Probably. Right, well, I can't quite remember but I do remember giving him some feedback, yes.
I'm suggesting to you that you provided some feedback to him on the 5th of December. Mr. Woolridge, could we please have WIT.0040005.0001? Scroll down the page to where we've got figure one and figure two.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps if we could just enlarge those two. Where the two, figure one with the emoji after it and figure two with the emoji, please. So you agree with me that figure one, you've got an unhappy face emoji. Figure two, you've got a happy faced emoji.
I can only remember, I think that was a bit of an internal joke, that figure one might have been a pie chart, and I don't particularly like pie charts.
Mm. Well, you agree with me that those emojis mean you liked one and didn't like the other?
Like I said, if I remember correctly, it was just an indication that it was a bit of a joke with Justin, because it's a running joke in the management team that I didn't particularly like pie charts as a way to represent data.
All right. Well, could we go, please, to FSS.0001.0034? And go to page 10, please.
Oh, it is a pie chart.
That's the pie chart that you didn't like?
Oh, well, it was just a general joke about the fact that I'm not a big fan of pie charts as a way to represent data.
Well, that pie chart, though, identified that the success rate for auto-microcon samples was 10.6%.
Yes.
You thought this was an unhelpful way of presenting the data?
No, it's not what I was actually trying to say, because I understand that pie charts, when there's a limited number of data points, for example, there's just a A or B data point here, they are not a bad way to present the data. It was, like I said, more of an internal joke between Justin and I.
Because you understand that within this paper, success and fail were clearly defined at the outset, correct?
From memory, I think it is, where it's talking about a DNA profile that's able to be interpreted and one that's not. Is that correct?
Yes. So in that sense, it's a binary concept. You've got something that either succeeds or it fails.
It's able to, yeah.
Yeah.
Another way.
So a pie chart in this instance is a pretty good way of representing simple data like that, isn't it?
Yes, it wasn't something where I was saying to Justin, you can't have that as a pie chart. It was, like I said, it was a little internal joke about the fact that Al doesn't like pie charts.
Okay. Well, if we go down to the page, to the next page, please. This is figure two. You like that one, though?
It's not a pie chart.
Is that right?
That was the joke. It was just a little joke to Justin that I don't like pie charts, and one's a pie chart and one's not.
Do you think that figure two is a better representation of the data that the study identified?
I guess it does provide a bit more information. It's a little hard to read, to be honest. There's a lot of extra decimal points and significant figures there are quite large. It is a little hard to read.
Do you agree that as a data set it's likely to be skewed fairly heavily towards the lower quant samples because of the higher numbers of examples in those various quant categories?
Depends on how you're reading it. I think there's a reasonably visual approach there where you can see that the blue lines are a lot smaller than the red lines at one end of the chart, and they get closer together in their height as you go towards the top of the chart.
Well, certainly an untrained person looking at that would look at it and see that there's a lot of red and not much blue.
At the bottom, and then further up the top there's more blue and less red. Yeah, that's why I think it's a little bit more visual.
Now, this paper or the draft version of it, were you aware of any controversy amongst the scientists at the laboratory about it?
I mean, obviously, since I have become aware there's been a lot.
I'm talking about at the time.
At the time, I can't really remember it being something that was a big controversy, no. I mean, again, we're talking something that was sort of about 5 years ago, and there's lots of things going on at the laboratory. We've already talked about sperm microscopy, which is around that same time. Lots of things happening. I can't remember exactly what was a big controversy. And I didn't stick, put it this way, it didn't stick out in my mind.
All right. One thing, though, is quite clear that what was being proposed by this draft paper was that microconcentration in respect of low quant samples would cease when it came to P2 samples.
I think so, yeah.
But not P1.
I have to go back and read it again. Does it say that?
All right. Well, let's go then to another document. Just bear with me a moment, please. Yes, could we go please to WIT.0040.0007.0001? It's exhibit 5 to your statement.
Mm-hmm.
These are the minutes of a meeting. You see, you're an apology. Okay. But we see at 5.7 on page 2, that there's reference there to an option paper being drafted for priority 2 samples.
Yes.
Am I right that that's how you understood it, that what was going to happen was that it would be priority 2 samples where microconcentration would stop?
I assume so. If you think of it in a way that if it's an efficiency measure where we don't process the sample automatically, then QPS gives us information to process if it's important. Obviously, the P1s are more important, so it would be less efficient to then ask for them to give us information, ask them to do it again. So it'd be just more efficient to do it straight away.
Perhaps if we go back to FSS.0001.0001. 0834 at page 20. See at the top of the page, based on the data analysis, the following recommendations are offered. Cease auto microcon processing with the following exceptions, priority one samples.
Yeah.
So what I'm getting at is it was never your understanding that what was being proposed and indeed what was implemented applied to P1 samples.
I can't remember what my understanding was at the time, but that would appear what all the paperwork suggests, yes.
You're not aware of any document that would have caused you at the time to think that this was a process that was being suggested across the whole range of samples, including P1, having regard to the documents that you've been shown by Mr. Hunter and having a regard to the status of P1 samples as something to which an...
Yeah, I don't really recall it being something about P1 samples, no. Thanks. That's just my memory.
Thank you.
It would make no sense in the case of P1 samples, would it?
I guess not, unless they're talking about... it depends on what sort of... if processes are in place across... they're monitoring the results and giving us feedback. But generally speaking, I would say that, yeah, it would be more efficient to just take them all and work them all straight away.
All right, anyway, we know that up until early 2018, the process was that for P1 and P2 samples, they were all auto-microconned.
Okay.
Is that you understood that, didn't you?
Yeah, I'm not sure of the dates, that's all. Sorry, when you say early 2018.
Let's assume for present purposes that the options paper, as it's become known, was presented to police in early 2018.
Okay, right.
Prior to that point, samples in the low quant range
were auto-microcon. Automatically put through the microcon process, yes.
They were never amplified without first being microconcentrated.
I don't think so. I'm not quite sure whether auto-microcon was something we did straight away after we implemented PowerPlex 21 or something we brought on subsequent. I can't quite remember.
Certainly immediately prior to 2018.
Yeah, immediately prior.
There was never a situation where low quant samples were amped without first being microconcentrated.
Yes.
And there were procedures, that standard operating procedures, that documented all of this, correct?
I assume so, yes.
In terms of microconcentration, though, there were different approaches in terms of the extent to which a particular sample would be concentrated.
Yes. We've already talked about 35, 15 elsewhere in evidence, I believe.
But sometimes scientists would ask that a particular sample be microconcentrated to full.
Yes.
And there was a standard operating procedure for that too, wasn't there?
Well, it was kind of the same part of that whole, the standard operating procedure for microcon, as far as I understand, was that the analytical scientist would look at the notes, and if there was, I think 235 was the default, and so if there's no notes, you would microcon to 35, but if there was a request to microcon to full, you would microcon it down to a level which you could. Sometimes it wasn't in the actual physical nature of doing it, the sample just won't concentrate down lower than something more than that.
But my point is that microconcentration to full was something that had been happening for some years prior to 2018, hadn't it?
As far as I'm aware, it was an option all the way from when I very first started at FSS.
When was that?
2004.
Can I ask you then about the decision in June of this year? Particularly on the 6th of June, are you aware of the decision I'm talking about how to change the workflow with respect to the DIFP?
Is this following some DG memo?
Yes.
Yes, okay.
That there was a decision made that all samples in the DIFP quant range would be sent directly for amplification.
Yes.
You recall seeing that?
I remember
seeing a memo going around?
Yes.
What section were you working in at that time?
This year, I was a reporting scientist. Oh.
Did it strike you as an odd decision to make to amp these low quant samples without first micro-concentrating them?
A little bit, yes. I thought that the department was, it seemed to me that they were working off some wording of what the Director General had said. I can't really remember. I just remember just, okay, this is the new rule. Okay, I'll work under this paradigm now.
I mean, you knew, though, that prior to 2018, it had been identified that amping these low quant samples without micro-concentrating them simply led to marked stochastic results.
Yes.
Well, did it occur to you in June of this year, when you saw what was being proposed, that that process was likely to be a complete waste of time?
I wouldn't agree with that because, I wouldn't agree with that.
You wouldn't agree with it? Well, no. What was it likely to achieve?
Well, you can get an indication from the profile when it is amped as to whether it might be better to micro-con it to 35 or micro-con it to 4 because you have an indication of what's in that.
But doing that potentially wastes 15 microliters of the sample, doesn't it?
Well, it's not a waste if you get some information from it.
Do you agree with me that amping a low quant sample in the DIFP range without first micro-concentrating it was likely to lead to a result that was forensically useless?
Yes.
Yeah, nobody's trying to put responsibility on you in any way for this process. What's being asked for is your expert opinion about the process and what you think about its efficiency or lack of efficiency. That's what Mr. Hunter's after.
Yes, sorry if I sound a little vague, because I think there's a little bit of nuance there that's not really being discussed.
Well, what I'm putting to you is that what was proposed in June of this year with respect to samples in this range was completely different from how they had been treated immediately prior to the start of 2018.
I'd agree with that, yes.
And can I get you to explain, please, what useful result you think might come from proceeding to directly amplify a low quant sample?
So if you got indications that there's a very large number of contributors, and it doesn't matter if you're going to concentrate it, as soon as you get more than four contributors in a mixture, you know that you can't interpret that because we haven't validated to interpret those higher order mixtures beyond four people. So if you get something that's straight up, you can see that it's a very complex mixture. There's no point concentrating because you're not going to be able to interpret it. Well, so that's one example.
Well, and, just pausing there.
Sure.
How do you know whether what you're seeing is in fact a number of contributors or merely an example of these stochastic effects?
Okay. So, when you've got I think you've probably already heard evidence about how you interpret pieces of information from both parents and you get one copy from your mother, one from your mother. Mm-hmm. So you would expect to see no more than two pieces of information at a particular locus when you've got a single source profile. No more than four if you've got a two-person mixture. So, therefore, if you see nine peaks, it has to be at least five people.
Unless the peaks are a result of the stochastic effects about which we've been discussing.
If you've got nine peaks that appear to be allelic, it's a five-person mixture at least, regardless of whether the stochastic effects are there or not.
I see. Right.
So there's like a number of peaks above which, so, you know, if you've got eight peaks which appear to be allelic, you may have four, but you might have five. You've only got six, you might have three people, but you might have four or you might have five. So you need more information across the profile. But as soon as you see enough to make five people, you know that there's at least five people in that mixture.
But you don't know any of that when you get your quant, which is a low quant. All you know is you've got a low quant.
That's what I'm saying about when you get it amplified straight up. And when I said that by amplifying it straight up, do you necessarily, is it a waste of time? Well, not necessarily if you get some usable information from that profile.
Yes, if you do, but...
if you don't.
If you don't, what do you do?
Well, then you would need to micro-concentration.
That's right. So why don't you take that step in the first instance?
Oh, I'm not saying that it's the most efficient way of doing it, but I don't say it's a complete waste of time is what I'm
yes,
saying.
I understand. Yeah. Yes.
Thank you.
Which is the more efficient way of doing it, do you think?
Oh, I think the auto microcon.
Thank you. Can you tell us about any other advantage of directly amplifying low quant samples?
Sometimes, from what I can recall, you might see that it's a very clear single source profile matching the person the sample's been taken from. And so... see yes. that profile is going to match the person that the sample has been taken
from. The likelihood of that is surely pretty low, getting a clear single source profile.
Depends on the source. If it's taken from a sample that's been taken from an intimate site on someone, then it's highly likely you'll get a profile matching the person that you're sampling.
If it's possible, and you think it's this is an advantage of amplifying these samples directly, that is that you might get a single source profile.
I didn't believe I said it was an advantage.
Well, I asked you whether there was any other advantage of directly amplifying these low quant samples, and you told me that you might get a single source profile.
So my apologies. I didn't mean it was an advantage over the alternative of micron process, but there was some utility in it. I was meaning that it wasn't a complete waste.
Because if there was some utility in it, that would, you understand that under the DIFP regime that applied prior to June of this year, you wouldn't even have the opportunity of getting this rare single source profile because the DIFP samples wouldn't get tested at all, would they?
Correct. Well, unless we were requested to do so.
Yep. And lastly, in connection with the reporting of these directly amplified low quant samples. Let's say you get a complex mixture that's incapable of being interpreted, or you get stochastic effects or whatever, something that is effectively meaningless insofar as the police are concerned. The police would still get a reported result, though, wouldn't they?
Yes.
Yeah. And the way these samples would get reported on the forensic register would be different from the way they would previously have been reported for DIFP.
Yes, so previously they would get a line that says DNA insufficient for processing, and then if we amplified it and we had some sort of profile result, we don't provide them with that result line. I might need a drink of water. We would report them with a result line that reflects the DNA profile.
Right. But what I'm getting at is under the DIFP regime, at least there would be clearly set out in the forensic register the prospect that the sample could be further tested by way of microconcentration or pooling or whatever.
That's my understanding, yes.
But post 6 June, the report to the police would suggest, well, this is it. This is what we've done, and this is the result.
I think so.
Would have been nothing to suggest to the police, look, there's potentially 75 mil or so, maybe 85 mil of sample left over. We might be able to micro-concentrate that and perhaps get a result. There was nothing that suggested that to them.
I don't believe there's anything in the forensic register that suggests that.
Thank you. Oh, yes. What page is that? Which document is that? Sorry. Okay. Please go back to your email of the 5th of December 2017, which is wit.0040.0005.0001.
What's the date of that?
The 5th of December 2017. We go please, to the bottom of the page where the word recommendation two appears. When you say you'd support up to 0.02 nanograms per microliter, so what were you saying there?
Look, I can't remember exactly, but it looked to me that I was thinking that I must have been looking at some sort of data and thought it was a point where I was happy that samples below that were more likely or less likely to provide some utility. I go on to say that, you know, it still gives QPS the option to ask for more work on the sample. I think I was on the understanding that there'd be quite a decent dialogue between the lab and QPS about what gets further worked and what doesn't.
See, recommendation two, and I can put it up on the screen if you need to see it, but what I'm suggesting to you, it says is cease processing all priority three samples up to the quantification value of 0.0133 nanograms per microliter. Right? And in your email, you said you'd support up to 0.02.
Okay.
So you're suggesting that it was worthwhile abandoning the testing of even more P3 samples than the option paper was recommending, correct?
I was just saying that if they wanted to go higher, I'd support that. I can't remember exactly my exact thoughts around that at the time, but maybe there was some data I saw that showed that 0.0133 or something?
0.0133.
Yeah, so maybe I saw that there wasn't much difference in the data between 0.0133 and 0.02 or something. I can't actually remember that data.
That's my question, sir.
Thank you. Mr. Rice?
Thank you.
Yes?
No, thank you.
Mr. Hickey?
Just one issue. Commissioner, Mr. McNevin, the Commissioner received some evidence from Dr. Moller to the effect that she had observed you being belittled by Ms. Allen. Is that something that you have any personal recollection of?
No.
Thank you. Those are the questions.
Thank you. I just wonder if you could help me with a couple of things, Mr. McNevin.
Yes.
Excuse me a moment. On this business of the cleaning change was instituted, I think you mentioned that you looked at project 148,
yes.
A project in relation to optimizing the cleaning protocol for bone crusher vials. Did you say that in your report?
Yes.
Could document WIT. .0003.0456.0007 be put on the screen. Now, they were your colleagues who wrote this report were concerned with working out a protocol for washing vials that are used in the testing of bone samples.
Yes, these special little
tubey
things.
Yes. And so in order to work out how they were to be cleaned, we see in the second paragraph on the third line, the purpose of this equipment control is to show that the crushing vial is free from contaminating DNA. So the purpose of the cleaning is to get rid of any DNA samples that might have been there before, and so that the vial is clean of DNA for the next testing process, correct?
Yes, I think that was like a historical process that maybe sometime in the past that had some issues, and so they implemented this use of an equipment.
Yeah,
I'm not really sure
how. The purpose is to find out what kind of a washing of the vials will ensure that when the vial is reused, it doesn't have any DNA in it.
Yeah, so I think they collected those, if I remember correctly, they'd collect that before they used the piece of equipment?
You see in paragraph 3, to have confidence in our results, we investigated alternative cleaning protocols to ensure that the amount of contaminating DNA was sufficiently reduced.
Yes.
All right. So if we look at the second last paragraph, any suitable cleaning protocol must not damage the stainless steel components of the crushing vials by causing rusting or pitting.
Yes.
Now, what cleaning substances in the lab might have that effect?
Generally speaking, I think bleach is
the
most corrosive sort of chemical that I believe that we use.
Yeah. All right. And then if you could put up on the screen WIT0003-0427-0016. Could I give you a different number? I'll give you a different number. WIT0003-0456-0016. Now, if you look at the bar chart there, just familiarize yourself with it.
Mm-hmm.
Now that, as I understand it, and you can look at more of the document if you want, assumes that there are 40 alleles in the samples that they're using because they're test samples.
Yes.
And they've cleaned a vial that's been swabbed with DNA-containing sample, and they've cleaned it with water, Tergozyme, Decon 90, Trigene, and Dishwasher Special, which is the dishwasher using the substances that they
cycle it.
Yes. And they found that Tergozyme is pretty good. The Dishwasher Special is also good in that after washing, you have close to zero alleles in it.
Mm-hmm.
And Trigene is worse than water because you have almost all of the alleles are still there.
Sort of, in that Nanopure water had a broader spread.
Yeah.
Potentially, it looks like that chart is trying to show that there was more than 40 from some of the Nanopure waters.
But generally, is not very good. So if we go to the paragraph just below the graph,
it's actually kind of an odd finding.
Perhaps, but it's a finding. So we're stuck with it. If you look at the paragraph below, the second sentence, because of this result, Trigene Advance was considered not suitable for cleaning bone vials.
Mm-hmm.
Then, if we go, please, to in the same document to page 0.0019. In the large second paragraph at the end, that is the conclusion that's drawn, that Trigene shouldn't be used.
For the cleaning of the bone vaults, yes.
Yeah, because it didn't decontaminate effectively. Am I understanding it correctly?
Yes, because they were using dried saliva stains.
Then if you go to please in the same document to page 0020. The recommendation in the middle is that the Miele dishwasher with its special cycle is the best method, and Tergozyme can be a viable backup. Now, is there a reason why using the Miele machine wasn't appropriate for the bone instruments with which you were concerned?
You mean something other than the crusher vials?
Yes. You changed the cleaning system, as I understand it, for bone equipment from whatever it had been using Tergozyme to a different set of substances for cleaning. What I'm asking you is that was there any reason why the dishwasher system that's referred to in paragraph six was not suitable?
It's probably just that it didn't occur to me because I hadn't really thought about that we had this validation just referred to bone crusher vials.
Yeah.
So I was going to use the protocol that had been laid out in this validation for bone crusher vials. And I guess it probably didn't occur to me that that may also be suitable for other pieces of equipment. I guess it might have been something as simple as that.
Mm-hmm. So if we go, please, to... document WIT.0003.0457.0001. That's the change management register entry.
Yes.
And just help me with this, if you wouldn't mind. Change in bone processing equipment, cleaning protocol, cleaning of the bone crushing equipment using the dishwasher as per proposal 148, use bleach and or Trigene, followed by alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what's the purpose of the alcohol? Is it to remove the bleach or Trigene?
Sort of, yes. It's also, I would have to go back, but I seem to remember some time previous reading some journal articles where it's not just the chemical action of the cleaning agent that reduces the presence of DNA, but also the mechanical action of the wiping it away.
Mm-hmm.
So you have your twofold chemical action followed by wiping down with your bleach and ethanol.
Now the...
your 70% ethanol.
Now the bone crushing equipment we're considering, can you tell me what that is?
That's your vials,
yes.
The impactor, the cylinder, and the bungs.
Yes. So what are the bungs made of?
So I believe they're a rubber type material.
Yeah.
I think they are because the impactor is a metal piece that slides it. So you have a tube.
Yes.
And the tube, you have a bung on each end and a bit of metal tube. A metal cylinder that sits inside that tube.
Yes.
And so then you have your pieces of bone that are being exposed to liquid nitrogen, so they're quite brittle.
Yeah.
You all know the experience of it. And so then the machine shakes that vial and the bit of metal inside bangs around and crushes up the bone.
Mm.
And so I believe that those bungs are rubber, but I couldn't be certain.
Mm. Yeah, it uses a familiar device of you get a cylinder or a ball, steel ball or something made of some, or a ball made of something, glass or something. And you put a hard object inside with the thing you want to crush and you shake it,
basically.
And the thing inside breaks it into pieces.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yes, yes.
And the thing inside that's breaking it into pieces, what's that made of?
I think that's the impactor. I think that's the stainless steel bit.
All right. And then what else do they use in the bone crushing equipment line?
Well, that's there's the actual liquid, the actual crusher itself.
Yes.
The instrument that you pour the liquid nitrogen in, that little vial goes in that shakes the living.
But you don't. Do you clean that after use?
Look, I'm not actually sure, but my expectation is that my staff would certainly be wiping down the outside.
What about the chisels and all of that?
I would imagine all of that. That's this. I think I would have referred to that as sampling equipment because that's what you do prior.
So, were you changing the cleaning protocol for that equipment as well? Because.
I do believe so. I can't remember. There's an email there that's already been tendered ever, so I think, I've outlined what I was actually changing.
Ms. Hedge, the email, I don't have the number of it, but it's dated the 21st of June 2019 from Mr. McNevin to the management team. And you referred to it, I think, during Ms. Keller's evidence.
Yes, I do have that. FSS.0001.0056.8821.
So I think that's the bone processing equipment is the broader picture of the bone crusher plus the sampling bits.
Just check that's the right one, Commissioner. Is that the email? It's on the screen now.
Yeah, I think that's where I stepped out.
Right. Well,
change.
Why don't you read it, Mr. McNevin, and I'll read it as well.
Yeah, so that's where I'm stepping out what changes I'm looking to use. I think in the second bottom paragraph from the bottom of the page there, therefore I'm proposing that we eliminate Turgesheim to do the following things.
Now, at the bottom of that email, the second last paragraph, you propose mm-hmm. that we eliminate the use of Turgesheim, and we know why, mm-hmm. why that was so, and implement the cleaning of the bone crushing equipment using the dishwasher,
mm-hmm.
use bleach and or Trigene.
Yes.
Now, isn't that bleach as a rust causer and Trigene as something that fails to eliminate DNA, something that Project 148 said you shouldn't use?
Well, only in the specific instance of the testing that was done on those bone-crushing vials. If you look at Project 153, we'd decided that Trigene was quite useful, and I think there's a lot of literature to show you that Trigene's actually quite a good cleaning agent.
Let's just take it a step at a time.
Sure.
Here you're proposing the cleaning of vials, you said a moment ago. You told me that a moment ago.
Yes, there's two steps there. There's the cleaning of the vials and the cleaning of the sampling equipment. So overall, the bone processing.
Yeah.
Yes.
Mm. So why would you be using something to clean the vials that Project 148 said shouldn't be used to clean the vials?
I believe that that's what that line, implement the cleaning of bone-crushing equipment using the dishwasher, refers to the vials.
As per Proposal 148.
Yes.
Proposal 148 expressly said, don't use something that causes rust and we don't recommend Trigene. You remember that?
Yes. Sorry, I'm a bit unclear on your question, Commissioner.
Yes. You recommended eliminating Turgesheim for good reason.
Yes.
And instead, implementing the cleaning of the bone crushing equipment as per proposal 148 using bleach and Trigene.
No, sorry, I beg to differ.
Tell me what it means. Two
different points there. The first point, the first dash, implement the cleaning of the bone crushing equipment using the dishwasher as per proposal 148.
Yeah.
And then everything else other than the bone crushing equipment, clean using these alternative protocols.
Right. And what is everything else?
Well, you know, the bench, the all the bits and goods and chattels that you use, whether it was chisels or hammers or
forceps. And so reason Trigene was not recommended was that it was not effective in removing DNA.
From the bone-crushing vials under that specific test that was done for the bone-crushing vials. There's plenty of other literature, including Project 153, that says the Trigene is actually useful.
I see. So if we look at Proposal 153, we'd find support for its use in cleaning and bleach, I gather, cleaning metal tools.
It was used, I believe, that Project 153 was about cleaning blood away from. We used a petri dish.
Yeah.
I don't think the actual surface was tested, per se.
What I'm concerned about is this, and I don't know the answer. I'm hoping you can help me. Project 148 concluded at page 18
mm-hmm.
that Trigene Advance was not considered suitable for cleaning the bone vials, and that's because it failed to clean off the DNA.
Yes.
And that posits
in that report because they were using saliva as the source of the DNA.
Yes.
So one of the issues here is that we weren't crushing bone and testing the ability of equipment to clean DNA from bone off the equipment because,
Oh, I see. I might have missed that.
Yes.
You're saying that
Project 153 was cleaning blood.
Trigene might be useful for getting rid of any trace of alleles if the DNA was deposited by means of whatever's in bone.
It could be, yes. And so Project 1.3...
Where does one get that?
I think that's part of your problem is that the sampling of bone and bone samples are a little bit hard to come by. you know, you don't go sampling a large number.
I'm still troubled by this, that I have a report in front of me that says that Trigene Advance was not considered suitable for cleaning the bone vials. And that's because we see from the bar graph that the test showed that it didn't tend to get rid of
DNA.
And these are bone vials we're talking about, not saliva tests, but bone vials.
But the bone vials were impregnated with saliva.
I know. So are you saying that the test was flawed then? They used the wrong substance. They should have used bone.
It's a limitation of the testing.
I see. That's your opinion. Does it appear anywhere in the report?
I don't believe so.
No.
I think, actually, there's a part of the discussion. Isn't the discussion cover about saliva and proteins or something?
What we might do is adjourn, and I'd invite you overnight, please, to read Project
148.
And the other one that was referred to in the
153.
151?
Three, I think.
153. Because I don't understand it at the moment, because it appears to me that bone crushing equipment was to be cleaned in a particular way, but expressly not with Trigene and not with anything that causes rust. But the new protocol for the cleaning of bone equipment, bone crushing equipment, including metal objects, was to use those substances. Now, having regard to the tenor of what you're saying to me, my view is mistaken, but I need to know why it's mistaken.
Okay.
So if you wouldn't mind looking at those documents and anything else that you need.
Okay.
And Ms. Hedge will give you a copy of those two documents and anything else that you want, so that you can explain the technology behind this problem that I see. Thank you. We'll adjourn until 9:30, I think. Is that right?
All rise.